Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we look at the new research psychologists are conducting into hoarding. Compulsive hoarding is more prevalent than you may think. In fact, if you think, you may know a relative or a friend that displays some aspect of this disorder. Until the early 1990s, there was little research into this disorder. In fact, psychologists do classify this as a disorder now. But now the most recent estimate is that up to 5% of world population displays some aspect of clinical hoarding. The characteristics include the acquisition of large amounts of useless items and either neglecting or refusing to get rid of them, cluttered living spaces to the point that the spaces can't be used as intended, and being unable to return borrowed items, which sometimes leads to theft. My guest today is a leading researcher in hoarding disorder, Dr. Randy Frost. He's a professor of psychology at Smith College and an author on several books for professionals and laymen alike on hoarding, including Stuff, Compulsive Hoarders and the Meaning of Things. He'll be giving a day-long presentation for professionals and the community tomorrow as Life Senior Services presents Buried in Treasure, Understanding Hoarding Disorder. Community presentation will take place tomorrow afternoon at 4:15 at the Marriott Southern Hills. Dr. Frost joins us today by phone. Dr. Frost, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
In the beginning of your book, Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding, you tell the story of what apparently became a fairly famous story in the 1940s, the story of the Collier brothers. In fact, in New York City, a hoarder became known as a Collier tenant. Tell us the story of Langley and Homer Collier, which you open your book with.
Yes, this is a really interesting story back in the 1940s, and it all began with a call to the police station. The caller said there was a dead body in the Collier mansion. So they thought it was credible enough that they sent a police officer, went to the door, couldn't get in, and they kept trying to get in for 2 hours, look for a way into the house, and finally they ended up calling a fire truck, and they brought a ladder in, and they put the ladder up to the second floor window, and policemen crawled up there, got in the room, and what he found inside, the room was packed full of stuff all the way almost to the ceiling. It was about 2 or 3 feet between the top of the stuff in the room and the ceiling. So the officer crawled in there, and in an opening in the middle of the room, he found the body of Homer Collier. And so that set off the search for his brother Langley, who was caring for Homer. Homer was paralyzed and blind, and Langley had taken care of him. But now they have his house full of stuff. So they decided they'd go through the front door. So they basically knocked the front door in, chopped it down. But they couldn't get in that way because it was so packed with newspapers that were tightly bound. And so the only way they could get in to start searching for Langley was to go into the room where Homer was found. And now they're also trying to get Homer's body out. So the only way, they couldn't find any other way in or out, so they had to take his body down this ladder. And they decided they needed to try to clear the house, thinking Langley might be inside somewhere. So they punched a hole in the roof and started going down, because the engineers told them if they started at the bottom with all the stuff that was in the house, the building would collapse.
Wow.
Because of all the weight. Now, during this time, they didn't have any idea what happened to Langley, and they thought maybe he's out somewhere. So they put out an all-points bulletin for 13 states, all the northeast region, looking for Langley. At one point, the search for Langley got so intense that they stopped the subway train before it got to a station because someone called, said that they saw Langley get on the subway line. And for 3 weeks, this dominated the news in New York City. Every day, there was a front-page story in the New York Times about the Collier brothers and how they were taking all the stuff out of the house. And thousands of people gathered around the house and watched them. And they had to start by pulling stuff out through the roof, throwing it down on the street, and hauling it away. And then 3 weeks later, they discovered Langley's body, only about 10 feet away from where they found Homer. And what had happened was, not only was the home full, but Langley, who was an engineer, he studied engineering, he had constructed a series of tunnels through all this stuff. And that was the only way he could get around in the house. And he'd booby-trap the tunnels.
Why would he booby-trap the tunnels?
Well, one of the things that happened over the years was that these brothers became labeled as eccentrics. And so they became sort of a subject of curiosity in the neighborhood and people trying to break in, because the rumors were that their home was packed with stuff, but it was also packed with millions of dollars. That was the rumors. And so people were trying to break in to steal stuff. So there was, you know, they were a little bit paranoid, but, you know, the paranoia had some basis. also, when you get a room that full, it is really hard to get around.
Right.
And this set of tunnels was quite elaborate, and some of them were like mole holes, where you get to the end of the tunnel, and you can keep going, but you have to take the stuff in front of you and put it behind you to keep going.
Wow. And so he bumped into one of his booby traps, and literally the tunnel collapsed on him.
That's right. And so the thinking is that he died first, and Homer, being only about 10 feet away, couldn't care for himself and died sometime later, and probably knowing what happened to his brother. And this became lore in New York City because of all the media attention. And now the fire department, if they identify a house that has a hoarding problem, they call it a Collier residence. So it's a part of the lore. And they had to tear the building down because it was so structurally unsound from disrepair.
They actually pulled cars out of the house. Is that right?
Yes. There were several cars, lots of buggies, 14 grand pianos. Langley was also a concert pianist. He even debuted at Carnegie Hall. The brothers were quite intelligent. Both of them were educated at Columbia, Phi Beta Kappa. So they were really quite bright and were the sons of one of the wealthier families in New York. So it was quite an unusual sort of thing to see these gentlemen sort of drift into not only this collecting behavior, but they also became quite reclusive. Now there are several plays that have been written and performed in New York City about the Collier brothers and around the country.
Now, this story sounds very extreme, but in fact, in the course of your working on this issue as a psychologist, this is maybe the size of the house is a little extreme, but the amount of possessions in it, perhaps not.
Right. We see a range of severity all the way from homes like the Collier brothers that are completely packed with stuff without the ability to move around inside to homes that have significant enough clutter that it affects the person's ability to live. And that's really the breaking point where this goes from being sort of an eccentricity to a real disorder, is where the accumulation of stuff interferes with their ability to live in their home.
So what is hoarding exactly? Is it a manifestation of obsessive compulsive disorder or something else, or a combination of things like that?
Until recently, it was thought of as a subtype of obsessive compulsive disorder. But the research we've done over the last 10 years or so makes it clear that it is quite distinct from OCD. We think there are a number of factors that go into it. First of all, it involves three distinct sets of behaviors. First is the accumulation of a lot of materials. And the accumulation, the behaviors of accumulating are a little bit different than the behaviors that most people engage in. There's a lot of compulsive buying, a lot of excessive acquisition of free things and so forth. Then there is this decision, this attachment that occurs to an object that is owned, and the decision to save that object and the inability to get rid of it. Even objects that other people would say, yeah, that's kind of crazy to keep. And then the third feature is a level of disorganization of this stuff. And all of this is tied up in the way in which information is processed. So there's a complex of things, these three different features. People with hoarding problems seem to process information differently. They also seem to form attachments to possessions that the attachments themselves aren't different, but they are more rigid and they're applied to many more things than most people. So the interesting thing about this problem is that the kinds of behaviors these people display are really no different than the kinds of behaviors all of us display toward the things we own, because things we own often have an essence for us. An essence that goes beyond the physical characteristics of those objects. So sentimental items, for instance, that ticket stub from a favorite concert, there's nothing about the physical structure of that ticket stub that gives it value. It's really the association you have in your head between that object and the event it's associated with.
But the ticket stub is a perfectly normal attachment, I would think.
Exactly. And it is for people with hoarding problems. But the difference is in the variety of things they use for that kind of attachment and the intensity with which they feel it. It's a little bit like it, and this comes back to this notion of identity and personal history, that these objects, for many of these folks, one of the motivations for saving them is that the object is the key to unlocking the memory of whatever is associated with that object. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
One of the people in our book stuff, the main character, Irene, I worked with her one day on getting rid of papers, and She came across an ATM envelope. This is an envelope she'd gotten 5 years before from an ATM machine that had cash in it. She'd spent all the cash, but on the back she'd written how she spent it. It was grocery store items, drugstore items, not anything all that unusual. She put it in our recycle box, and she started to cry. And what she said was, I feel like I'm losing that day in my life. And if I lose too much, there'll be nothing left of me. So this envelope was a key that unlocked the memory of that day for her. And it was a part of her personal history, a part of her identity. And it felt to her like she was losing a piece of herself by getting rid of this.
Was it a special day, or was it the fact that this was just an ordinary day that she would no longer remember, much as we all have ordinary days that we probably can't recall 5, 10, 15 years down the road, or a week?
Well, that's a great question, because what happened next was she, you know, in the way we treat this, we ask people to do experiments. And the experiment for her was leave it in the recycle box, because she wanted to take it out. And that was the experiment. See what happens if you leave it in the box. So she left it in the box. 10 minutes later, I asked her how she was feeling about that ATM envelope. And she said something unusual. She said, you know, that wasn't a very good day. And now she doesn't mind getting rid of it. So what it tells us is that what's happening with her is this initial rush of emotion about the possibility of losing a piece of herself, whatever piece that is, even though it may not be an important piece. And because of that rush of emotion, she avoids that unpleasant experience by saving everything. But when she experiments with getting rid of things, she discovers that, yeah, it's okay to let that go because it wasn't so special.
Now, one of the things about Irene was that amidst her enormous clutter, she could tell you something about everything that was in the house, most of the things that were in the house, right? She could tell you something about it, and she could tell you why it was being kept.
That's right.
Is that unusual?
No, it's not. It's quite common, and it's really a fascinating piece of this because it is like each of these things carries with it a host of information, and this is another piece of the puzzle here, is that the way in which people with this problem attend to the physical objects in their world is a little more complex. Another example, I showed up at Irene's one day and her eyes lit up and she said, I have to show you something. And she went into the next room. She came back with this large, clear plastic bag filled with bottle caps. And she said, look at these bottle caps. Aren't they beautiful? Look at the shape and the color and the texture. And when I see a bottle cap without a bottle attached to it, my thinking is unidimensional. It's trash. And what do you do with trash? But her thinking, all these other variables go into the way in which she processes information about this bottle cap. So to get rid of the bottle caps, she's got to work through all of those things before she can make the decision to get rid of it. So her thinking is much more complex about the object she owns.
Well, that's really interesting.
My thinking is.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, an artist might look at a bottle cap or an everyday object as an object that we should actually look at.
Absolutely. In fact, there's a connection there. If you look back in the history of the art world, who displayed that kind of behavior? Well, one of the people who did was Andy Warhol.
Right.
And if you look at Andy Warhol's life,
hoarder.
It looks like he had a hoarding issue. I don't know enough about the way he lived to know whether he would qualify for disorder, but clearly the behavior was there.
My guest today is Dr. Randy Frost, a professor of psychology at Smith College, and he is a specialist on hoarding complexes and hoarding disorders, as well as OCD. He's author of several books on the subject, including Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things, which came out 2010. Is that correct?
Right.
He'll be a guest of Life Senior Services as they present a one-day seminar on Buried in Treasure, Understanding Hoarding Disorder. That'll be taking place Tuesday, October 29th. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, a lot of people collect things, and I think a lot of people worry about the line between collection and hoarding. I think the third term that you use in hoarding, disorganization, are people like Irene aware of those bottle caps, say, buried beneath, you know, hundreds of pounds of other stuff? Are they still aware of that? A collector knows exactly what he has. Does a hoarder know everything they actually have in this huge mess?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, when we started with this, you walk into the home of someone with a hoarding problem, and you see what appears to be a disorganized mass. But the more we learn about it, it appears as though it's not that there is no organization, but the organization is different than it is for the rest of us. The rest of us live our lives categorically. That is, when we get an electricity bill, we put it in that category with other bills somehow, either in a folder or with utility bills or whatever. And now when we want to find that item, we go to the category and locate the specific item within the category. But for people like Irene, what happens when she gets an electricity bill is she puts it on top of the pile, a little bit over the left, where she can see it. And now this pile has a map, a three-dimensional map to it that is located in her brain. So she has a sense of what is in that pile of things. So it's not categorical, it's visual and spatial for her. She's got a sense that she knows where everything is. In truth, she probably makes a lot more mistakes than you would make if you had a categorical system, but she has a sense of what's there.
But one of the things that you also talk about is that hoarders often don't see the clutter.
Right. One of the things that happened, and we're not quite sure whether it's a habituation phenomena or something else. It probably is some form of avoidance, but when I was working with Irene on this problem, she told me once, she said, you know, when you're not here, and I'm by myself, I don't notice the clutter, and I feel okay. It just feels normal. It feels like home. It feels comfortable. But when you show up, I notice the clutter, and I feel horrible about myself. I feel like a complete failure. And then when you leave, I feel better again. So it's not a great place for a therapist to be, where you show up, and they feel horrible, and you leave, they feel better. But it pointed out something that it's a way for her to cope with this phenomena that is overwhelming. She can't control the clutter, so how does she deal with these horrible feelings she's got? Well, one way is to avoid recognizing it. Now, the other thing that we see here is quite a funny phenomena where when we go out to someone's home to begin with, we'll take pictures. And then when they come to our office, we'll show them the pictures. And 9 times out of 10, they look at the picture and say, that's my house. I don't even recognize it. That looks terrible. And it's as though showing them the picture or having someone show up at their home allows them to see their home through someone else's eyes in a way that they can't when they're by themselves and alone in the home.
Are there common traits between sufferers of this disorder, of hoarding disorder? Are there commonalities between or are there various types of hoarders?
There are various types, but it's not clear that there are specific types, but there are lots of different intricate pieces of it that differ across cases. Most people with this problem have great difficulty with decision-making of any kind, what clothes to put on in the morning, what to order off a menu. And we think that's tied to these information processing deficits, where they're trying to process so much information that they can't separate what's an important piece of information from what's a less important piece of information, and that makes decision-making difficult. Another common phenomenon we see, interestingly enough and quite surprisingly, is perfectionism. You wouldn't expect someone's home who looks this way to be perfectionistic, but often they're very concerned about making mistakes and wanting to do things exactly right and having things exactly perfect. And what that translates into is that because their house is overwhelmed, they can't get it to the way they think it should be, so they don't try, because even trying feels like failure, so they stop trying. And it's tied back to this sort of perfectionism that I've got to have it perfectly. They can't do it halfway.
Now, in reading about Irene, one of the first things that struck you, I think, as you were helping her was she said something like, well, why would you want to help somebody like me? So self-esteem, is this also a big part of it?
It is a big part of it. And we don't know yet whether this self-worth problem, this really low self-worth, is a vulnerability factor for the development of the disorder or it's a product of the disorder. Could be either one or it could be both. We don't know yet. But clearly, many people with this disorder feel just horrible about themselves. In fact, in a recent study looking at comorbidity, we found that over half of people with hoarding disorder met criteria for major depressive disorder. So it's really a major problem in terms of not only the way they feel, but how much motivation they have to do things.
I think humans, since their earliest development, have been collectors. And we're collectors to very different degrees. Is there a whole spectrum of hoarders, from the people who their houses are filled, the lawn overgrown, where, again, as you mentioned, they just give up, to people who have like maybe a section of the house that is a hoarding sort of situation?
Yeah, it does seem to exist on a continuum. And so there are people who collect and save things, and the psychological characteristics look much the same. The real cut point for when this is just an eccentricity versus when it's a disorder is the extent to which it interferes with their ability to use the living spaces in their home. Many people have lots of stuff filling their attics and their basements and their garages and so forth. None of that would qualify one to get a diagnosis of hoarding disorder. It's only the clutter that impedes on the living areas of the home that's important for diagnostic purposes.
And a lot of times those involve, like, trails.
Exactly. Trails, you know, 1 foot wide pathways through the piles of things.
Yeah. Well, what are we learning about treatment for hoarding disorder?
Well, we've developed a cognitive behavior therapy for hoarding that it shows some promise. We've done some of the initial studies with it, and we are able to get pretty good change. It's not perfect, and by the time people end treatment, they still have work to do, but they're significantly better. The difficulty with the treatment is that it's difficult. We have to teach therapists how to do it because it's a little bit different, and it takes a long time. The other thing that we've been doing recently and quite excited about is we're running workshops that are peer facilitated on hoarding, and we use our self-help book, Buried in Treasures. Each session of the group is devoted to a different chapter in the book. And then in between sessions, people do the exercises in the book. And it's facilitated not by a therapist, but by a peer facilitator, someone who's struggling themselves with a hoarding problem. And we have found pretty good results with this. We decided to do this because of a local hoarding task force here in the area was frustrated because there weren't very many resources for people with this problem. There were some therapists in the area who treated it, but the people who needed it often didn't have enough money to do it. So we were looking for what kind of resources exist out there. And one of the resources that we have with this problem are the people who experience it. They, for the most part, are quite talented and knowledgeable, bright people who we think can be a resource for helping each other with this problem. And so far, we've had pretty good luck with these Buried in Treasures workshops.
Now, when we think of hoarding, I think the perception is it's an issue of aging, although I know there are young hoarders, and from everything you're saying, this is more, depression plays a role, psychological makeup. Is there any sense of age being a part of this, or is it just a matter of, as you age, depression tends to be a part of it?
It's a little bit confusing. The research is a little bit confusing. Most of the people who show up for treatment and most of the people who get identified by health departments and so forth are people who are older. But when we interview people with this problem who are older and we start asking them really detailed questions about their behavior and what has happened to them in their life, it's clear that this behavior begins very early. And the behavior, the saving behavior, this relationship to possessions that's a little bit more extreme, seems to start in the early teenage years, between 11 and 15 years old. But it doesn't get severe until several decades later. And then by the time someone reaches 50, 60 years old, they've got a lifetime of accumulation that is impeding on their living space.
I want to ask about privation in early life, like maybe a trauma of going without, be it hunger or possessions. You grew up in the Depression, for example, and maybe you were homeless for a time. Have we found any link there?
Well, that was our first hypothesis. When we started this research years ago, our first hypothesis was that maybe these folks had lived through a period of material deprivation early in life. They didn't have enough stuff around them, didn't have enough resources. And so we began looking at that all the way back 20 years ago. And to our surprise, we found no evidence that that was tied to the development of this problem. And other people have since replicated that finding. So if that early material deprivation explains some hoarding, it's not very many cases. Now, it might be different if we start looking at other kinds of deprivation. We have a little bit of evidence so far, not much yet, but a little bit of evidence that the early family life might be characterized by sort of a coldness or a lack of warmth, and so that the attachments that form to other people are a little maybe less secure.
And so they turn to possessions instead.
So they turn to possessions instead. Now, but when we look at interpersonal behaviors, they seem perfectly fine with other people. When we look, there's a higher level of social anxiety in this group of people. So we think maybe there's a little bit of anxiety associated with you know, interacting with other people, and these things are more comforting. Another fascinating connection that we've found is that for people who have this problem, they tend to have experienced a greater frequency of traumatic life events by their report. But they don't seem to have an elevated level of post-traumatic stress disorder. And that raises the question of whether what's happening here is that these possessions form signals of safety that buffer them against the development of PTSD. Now, that's only a hypothesis at this point, only conjecture, but we do know that they experience more trauma. They report having experienced more trauma. We don't know yet exactly how that plays out, but it's a possibility.
One last question that has to do with a family member, a close friend that is exhibiting hoarding behaviors. What's the best intervention for somebody like that? I mean, if it is impeding their life circumstances, it's just because they have a dirty room in the back of the house, that doesn't mean intervention. But if the house is cluttered, pathways, what's the first good step?
This is a real tough problem for family members because it's so frustrating and they seem to have so little impact. And one of the reasons for that impact is that typically in a family situation, what you're dealing with is decades of conflict over this issue. So this is often something that plays out over a long period of time. And the family often fractures over this relationship because family members want to help. They try to help, but their help is perceived as intrusive by the person suffering the problem. And so they reject the help, and then the relationship breaks up. What we tell people is, first, one of the things you can do is simply get into the person's home. Simply show up. Visit them. You don't even have to mention the clutter. Don't talk about it. Just show up. Because one thing we know is when someone is coming over to their home, that's when they recognize the problem, as we talked about earlier. And they also will engage in behaviors to try to clean up if they know someone's coming. It's sort of a law of human behavior we all follow. If someone's coming to your house, you clean up. And we find it true of these folks, you know, just as much as everyone else. Even though their home is a wreck, they will spend time, and they know we're coming because we want to see how bad it is. They will spend time cleaning it up before we get there. So one thing people can do is just visit.
All right. Well, Dr. Frost, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Rich.
Dr. Randy Frost is a professor of psychology at Smith College, author of several books on hoarding, including Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding, and the Meaning of Things. He'll be conducting a seminar for Life Senior Services titled Buried in Treasures, Understanding Hoarding Disorders, tomorrow at the Marriott Southern Hills. The community presentation will take place tomorrow afternoon at 4:15. Information on the seminar is available at seniorline.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed any of our recent programs, they're available online at our website, publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa and you can search through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.